The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
Welcome to the Second City Works Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Improvisation at the world-famous Second City Theater. This podcast is about navigating work and life without a script. Improvisation is a practice in collaborating more effectively, tapping into your full creative potential, and building ensembles who can both support and challenge us. If you like what you hear, please rate us on iTunes and share the podcast through your social media channels. Help us extend the conversation. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tight and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back. Hey, Julie.
My guests today on Getting to Yes And are Paul Napper and Anthony Rao. Paul Napper leads a management psychology and executive coaching consultancy in Boston. His client list includes Fortune 500 companies, universities, and startups. He held an academic appointment and advanced fellowship position at Harvard Medical School. Anthony Rao is a cognitive behavioral psychologist. He maintains a clinical practice, consults, and speaks nationally, appearing regularly as an expert commentator. For over 20 years, he was a psychologist at Boston's Children's Hospital and an instructor at Harvard Medical School. They have a new book. It's called The Power of Agency, The Seven Principles to Conquer Obstacles, Make Effective Decisions, and Create a Life on Your Own Terms. Paul and Anthony, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks very much for having us, Kelly.
Hey, Kelly, how are you?
Good. So I think the perspective you each bring to this book is really interesting. Anthony is a child and family psychologist, and Paul is a management psychology expert. And in each area, you find that there is, quote, a lack of real humanness in people's lives. Anthony, how is this expressing itself in your field?
Well, I can just tell you, just, you know, the other day, just, you know, I had a 16, 17-year-old kid in the office, and just, he just stood up, got off the couch, and just was, you know, pacing around, and just, and this is really typical. More and more I've been seeing this last several years. These young people are just feeling like, you know, I'm a robot. You know, I've got all these pressures. You know, I'm in a world where everybody seems to be trying to get ahead of each other. And more and more, there are kids who are actually talking like they're having, you know, an existential dilemma at like 12 or 13. You know, they just don't feel authentic.
Yeah. Paul, what are you hearing in the business world?
Well, I hear with leaders that, number one, they're struggling to keep up with just the sheer volume of information, you know, coming at them. They're also dealing with teams of people who are also dealing with the same type of struggles. So the sheer amount of distraction and overwhelm is an ongoing problem for leaders at all levels, and you know they're more stressed. I mean, people are more stressed, and that affects decision making. So that's a huge thing.
So this is not something that's new, this sort of I and thou effect, right? Philosophers, psychologists have studied this forever in terms of, you know, issues of anxiety around a person in the community or person and people. But this generation in particular is battling something that other generations didn't have, and that's technology in a variety of forms that, when not held in check, become kind of dangerous, right?
Yeah, no, it's a great point, and it is the problem. I mean, it's one of the sources of the problem. You know, if you think back 30 years or 60 years, you realize how differently we used to live as human beings, and so this is a great new experiment that is being conducted, you know, each and every day for us, and people are struggling with how to best adapt. And as Tony said, you know, that affects adolescents and it also affects adults. So we're all in this together, and it is a struggle. It's a struggle to adapt to a completely new environment.
So specifically, Tony, social media and kids, I mean, it's not just fighting for attention. There's actually even more nuanced stuff going on in terms of like dopamine hits and otherwise that are really affecting the ability, and we're going to get to this next, of this idea of agency, but they really affect the ability of young people to have agency.
Yeah, no, absolutely. You know, Kelly, like agency is about you thinking for yourself and not following the herd. You know, being able to pause, take a moment, kind of like if you will, lean into yourself and figure out, like, you know, with some deeper thinking, like, who am I? What I want? Add social media to that, and just all the quick hits and all the social comparisons. You know, we are herd animals. You know, we do check in with each other constantly. We size each other up. And when you're in that really high self-consciousness phase of pre-adolescence and adolescence, I mean, it's damaging. All of the messages that are coming through nearly 24/7 at this point, throwing a lot of these kids really off. And after a while, they just start to develop anxiety, stress. They can't sleep. They don't know what it is. You know, to them on the outside, everybody seems good and happy. But inside, there's this core that they're just not keeping up.
I don't think it's a coincidence that when you take a beginning improvisational class, almost all the initial exercises are a kind of act of what I call group mindfulness. You spacewalk the room in silence together. You do mirror exercises. Sometimes you just count the bricks in the walls of the theater. And you can't have your phone with you. So all of this stuff is to sort of clear out the junk and have someone just sort of learn how to focus, because we're going to ask them to then use that focus intentionally. And you talk about this early in the book, that we have to sort of understand what our various stimuli are. And there's different kinds of stimuli. And when we understand that, then we potentially can control or try to control how that stimuli is affecting us.
Well, you want to think about all of the sources of information, stimulation. It could be vibrations, sounds, it could be smells in the room, and there's just all sorts of potential stimulation coming into your brain all the time. That's not a big deal, but a lot of it now is going right to your centers of your emotions. And once your emotions start sort of going upward, it's almost impossible, you know, to think for yourself. So we tell people start there. And I liked your expression a minute ago. It's like you got to get the junk out of your head. Yeah. I don't know if you've noticed this in your work, but just trying to get people to just really put the phone truly away and just to be able to have a moment where they have some space and quiet is almost intolerable. Like they have a hard time being bored.
Yeah, I've given this note in meetings because we'll be on a phone call and some of the younger people will be typing into their computer notes from the call. And I'll be like, you recognize that that's actually a more ineffective way of hearing what's yeah. going on, that physically if you write the notes, and you, I think you say this in the book, that there's
that's
data
right.
there's data behind the fact that that's more effective.
That's right. And reading, you know, for real, on pages, it's multi-sensory. You know, your eyes are actually scanning things in real space, and you're touching something, and if you're gripping a pen or a pencil, or if you're a child, a crayon, you know, there's all sorts of, like, movement involved, and the brain then records it in a more deep way.
And human agency is really about this capacity to reflect, to be grounded, and to reflect on, you know, where do I find myself? What are my options? What am I trying to do in my life? And so, you know, the parallels to, you know, improvisational action are huge.
Yeah.
And, you know, I love the training example you cited, Kelly, about, you know, trying to get people centered and grounded. Because what we discovered, you know, in doing the research on this book is that for people to have full access to their agency or their power, they need to have certain things be in balance. And when things are really out of balance, we don't have access, full access to our agency. So, you know, it is about clearing out the junk, as you said. And, you know, we've got a lot of stuff written these days about junk food and mm-hmm. you know, the importance of eating healthy food. And, you know, people are turning away from, you know, a lot of the fast food that's so unhealthy. But when it comes to information, we now have that problem because there's so much junk information and it's literally coming at us each and every minute of every day. It's shocking when you really start to add up where all of the messaging is coming from. It's coming from everywhere. It's coming from the gas pump to the taxi cab to, I mean, everybody is trying to get our attention.
Yeah. I got to the studio here about a half hour early, so I was looking on Twitter, and Dan Pink was just tweeted out a study that showed that much inspiration and great ideas that come to scientists and other thinkers comes when they're not intentionally working on the thing that they're supposed to be working on. They come sort of out of, like, daydreaming, or, you know, they're working on something completely else. And you actually have a great line in your book where you say you need to, quote, make boredom a habit. And that's, I think most people understand the idea of, like, yeah, you want to have focus, but what you also want to do is have some nothing time, right?
Absolutely. No, that's really great. I mean, the Buddhist concept of empty mind comes in here, which is what the Buddhists say is something is always created from nothing. And, you know, that sounds really heady, but the what it means, the bottom line is that, you know, when our minds are more neutral, not clogged with information, not, you know, not being sort of beaten up, you know, when they're relaxed and in a more empty state, something new, something creative can emerge. And so, you know, Daniel Pink's observation is a really powerful one. And that is one of the key problems with how we're living today, is many people do not have those kind of moments. They don't understand that it's important to create those moments for themselves, and they don't know what's being crowded out. They don't know what they're missing by not having those moments and creating those moments in their lives.
And what about just having access to your intuition, which is our, you know, it's our sixth principle? You know, you can't have access to all the amazing things going on under the surface. Your brain is constantly networking with itself and coming up with possibilities. And it's usually when you kind of take it offline from the thing that just happens to be right in front of you, that focused moment on something. So you get to some sort of like peaceful calm, or you focus on one nice thing, you go off for a little bit. We have to find like incredible ideas and moments of creativity just emerge.
So we don't live in the world alone. And I think, again, most people would understand the idea of sort of centering yourself. But yourself becomes different when you are in connection to others. So, you know, there's some science behind who we should be hanging out with, right?
Oh, absolutely. And this is core to agency. And, you know, before I move any further into that, because that's so critical, let's define agency, because a lot of people have asked us, what are you talking about? What is agency? And it's interesting, because agency as a concept has been talked about a lot within psychology, within philosophy and sociology, and the degree to which we as human beings have agency, which is this capacity to act, to think and act independently, to essentially create something new, and you know, how much do we have of that, and, you know, versus how much of it's just predetermined by the culture we're a part of. But essentially, agency is how you show up in your life. Mm-hmm. It's how you think and behave in the world, and it's your sense of power, of personal power in your life. So, you know, what we found is a lot of people feel cut off from this. They don't feel they have access to it. They feel they're living, you know, some other type of life that's not connected with what matters most to them. So it's vital, back to your question, Kelly, it's vital who we choose to surround ourselves with, because our level of agency is largely determined by who we spend time with. Who we surround ourselves with has great bearing on, you know, the ideas we have, you know, how we manage our emotions. So, you know, if we have people around us who are supportive, people we can learn from, people who challenge us, people who, you know, are exciting and make us, you know, who motivate us, you know, we're going to, you know, manifest those attributes in our lives. If we're with people who drag us down, who exhaust us, who, you know, see us as, you know, support to themselves exclusively, you know, we're gonna lose our power.
It's interesting, too. I didn't realize when I first got the book that you both have this background in the medical field, and we've developed, and I've talked a lot about this on the pod, we developed an improvisation for caregivers program with Cleveland Clinic, because what we found is there's agency is also situational as it relates to often to status. And inside, you know, a hospital room where you have a doctor, a nurse, a patient, a parent. There's a lot of different levels there. And I'm just going through this because I have a daughter who's getting treated at Lurie's Children's Hospital here. And the ability as a parent to understand where your agency begins and ends is very difficult to negotiate. In fact, I think most parents don't think they have agency when, in fact, they might have the most because they're the ultimate advocate.
Wow, great, great point. And, you know, and this, you know, what you're, I'm sure, dealing with your daughter is you're talking with many, many different providers, yeah. caregivers, with different areas of expertise. And, you know, one of the more obvious questions when you're in that kind of complex environment is who's the decision maker here? Mm-hmm. How are we going to make decisions? As a group, as a team, and you know, these are core issues when it comes to agency. Our capacity as human beings to make decisions. And so, when you're dealing with a health problem and multiple actors, you bring up a really important point, which is, you know, how do parents see their role in all of this? Mm-hmm. And what is the best role for parents to play in all this to ensure that the quality of care is really high?
The thing I've noticed the most that I try to do is guard against groupthink. If I've got, like, you know, because there's all these different teams that come in. So you got palliative and you've got oncology and then suddenly they agree on a point that I'm looking at going, no, I think you're agreeing on the wrong point. And the good news is I find that group of people very receptive to the outside eye. But that's also earned a bit. And you talk about that in the book, about the sort of social referencing and, like, you know, that you do have to sort of, I think you have to find a way to earn that. It's not actually given to you.
Unfortunately, the culture is changing a little bit, like in medical environments, yeah. where, you know, there's an idea now that, hey, you know, we've got all of these people in the room, including the parents, and parents know their kids the best. So, you know, if we find a way of sort of leveling this so it isn't just hierarchical and we get as much information out as possible, you know, we're going to have a better outcome.
Yeah.
Dr. Jerry Groopman wrote a book, he and his wife, both you know, prominent physicians, called Your Medical Mind, and he talks about this. Well, they talk about this, which is, in some ways, you know, patients and the families of patients always have a choice, and it's important that you exercise that choice or at least aware of that. And one of the primary choices is, who are the people on the team to care for who are caring for my loved one? And are these people I can trust? Are they people whose judgment seems sound to me? And I think, to your point, Kelly, a lot of families going through a problem, you know, a serious health problem, you know, it's such an emotionally difficult time. It's so easy to lose that sense of agency and not grasp it. I mean, because it's you know, it's so overwhelming. It can be so overwhelming. And so, but, you know, in that book, you know, Jerry Groopman talks a lot about that idea of choosing your medical provider, making sure it's someone or a team that you really believe in, and because obviously that's a really important thing to do.
And even when you get it right, like let's say you're surrounding yourself with some really smart people, and this really expresses itself, I think, most easily and it's very digestible to understand how this expresses itself in a business context, which is we sometimes assume expertise across a variety of fields when really the expertise is maybe only in one area, and we, you know, we don't change our perspective on other people when we need to. Like, not everyone is brilliant 100% of the time, and the only way we can get to sort of truth is if we ask a lot of questions, not just of ourselves, but of other people as well.
Great point. And sometimes, you know, we're all swimming in the same sea, right? Distracted, busy. You know, everyone's plate these days is so full. Mm-hmm. So within that context, it's easy for a human being to make a mistake. And I think that's where, as you said, you know, challenging, questioning, understanding how someone came up with that particular decision or position on an issue is really just simply good practice, whether it's a management team or whether it's, you know, in your case, you know, family, mm-hmm. Helping someone through a difficult health problem, you know, being able to question and understand and really you know, that's fundamental to agency, which is this idea of, hey, it should make sense to me. I should understand why you're recommending that particular course of action. And if you can't make it clear to me why that is your recommendation, I'm going to just keep asking you until it becomes clear,
right?
Because, you know, it should really make sense to me.
Yeah, I mean, and again, this isn't totally new. The Socratic method is around for a reason, and I always talk about.
That's right.
I had a playwright teacher who said, "If you can't tell me your play in one sentence, you don't have a play." and I think that's generally true for a lot of things. So we're talking a lot about the brain, but you also go into the fact that the body plays into this as well. So how does the body express itself with agency or without?
Great question. You know, and I'm sure you can relate to this. You know, given, you know, your focus, Kelly, you know, our bodies turn out to be far, far more important than we ever realized, you know, say 50 years ago. Our bodies really are the source of emotion, largely. Our emotions obviously affect our thinking. So when our bodies are, what that means is when our bodies are really not in good balance or not in good working order, our level of personal agency is really affected. You know, our ability to advocate for ourselves, our ability to make good decisions, can be compromised. So we write a lot in this book about the importance of, you know, keeping your body in better balance. So it's not simply through exercise, although movement and exercise are critical, but it's also ensuring that you're eating properly. It's ensuring that you're getting enough rest, that you're hitting the pause button frequently enough for those sort of down times, as we talked about earlier. Because the sad reality is a lot of people are not, their bodies are not in good working order. They're not in balance, and that affects everything else.
And they need to have an awareness of the signals that are coming from their body, which we tend to ignore. You know, I'm hungry, but I'm going to motor on. I think I can skip lunch. You know, I'd rather be watching Netflix rather than go to bed right now. Like, there's a lot of signals that we've been pushing back, you know, from sort of the child standpoint. I mean, I can't tell you how many years I've been seeing, you know, these complaints coming in. And I work with a lot of young men and boys, and just, you know, the increases in attentional deficit disorder diagnosing and medication, and sometimes it's been really helpful, but I can't tell you how many of these kids, if you just got them out of their chairs, maybe run outside for a little bit, take a walk down to the office to run an errand, give them frequent breaks, have them stretch, have them stand at their desks. We find that those symptoms, and the research backs this up, seem to go away for a little while. So the body is constantly sending signals to get up, relocate, invest yourself in something new, some new, cool, new stimuli of interest and importance to you. And the more that we ignore and suppress those signals, I think, you know, we lose our personal agency.
I was thinking about this in the context of both my kids went to Waldorf schools. And one of the things at Waldorf is they go outside all the time to run around. So they're in nature, which we also, there's some data behind the importance of that. But also you have to buy all this, like, raincoats and mittens, and, like, they have to have all, it's a pain in the ass, but it means that the kids are out expressing themselves, running around in nature every single day, no matter. I mean, the only thing that they don't go out in is a lightning storm. Everything,
you know,
else,
Kelly, it's like if they don't have, you know, the gloves, the mittens, the boots, or whatever, then a lot of these kids develop anxiety just being outside and in natural elements. I mean, we've seen this. We work with some of the camp organizations and administrators, and they're talking that more and more they're seeing kids who are just literally afraid to be outside. They're afraid of bugs and insects and large open spaces. So it starts young. Kids have to be able to sort of, you know, maneuver through the environment. We can't hover on them constantly, and they need, like, direct multisensory exposure to all those elements out there. That's where the brain developed, if you think about it, over hundreds of thousands of years, millions of years. It feels really comfortable in an outdoor environment.
So you're...
It grounds us. It really does ground us to be outdoors. The natural light, the fresh air. And we talk about this a lot in the book, which is that, you know, there's been a movement over the last, you know, 40, 50 years, in particular, toward being inside much more. So, you know, houses are, in America at least, are bigger and bigger. You know, people are obviously on screens a lot more. So, you know, we have a culture where, you know, we have more people being sedentary, spending more time indoors, and more time, you know, on electronics. So, you know, that can throw everything out of balance, you know, physically, right, and emotionally, and ultimately, of course, mentally as well. So that's terrific that your kids had that experience.
Yeah.
And think about this for a minute. I'm sorry to interrupt, but please. I was just thinking that, you know, if you're outdoors, chances are that's where you're going to have some of your most inspirational moments, some of your most creative moments, your best ideas. They often come when we're moving or we're outside. Mm-hmm. It's good, kind of keep track of that.
Yeah.
One quick anecdote on this. I had a good friend who grew up, on a farm 8 hours in a large family, 8 hours north of Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Mm-hmm. Okay, so this is a place that gets really cold. You know, there were 8 kids in the family. They were outside every day as kids, running around playing in the middle of the winter, mm-hmm, when it would be, you know, minus 30 degrees. I grew up in a cold climate as well, but I was shocked at this. But they did it, and you know, and they all grew up to be really healthy, creative, interesting people. But you know, we often think, you know, if it's you know, a little cold or a little wet, you know, oh, I can't go outside. But you know, it goes back to that old saying, you know, there's no such thing as bad weather, only bad equipment. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's partly true. We do better when we have access to the outdoors.
You know, you brought up something at the beginning of that conversation about, like, kids who don't have, you know, the right equipment, whether it's gloves or hats. And this is a thing that I've been struggling with lately, even in my own book and my own work, because realizing that what we're all talking about is you can have this agency, but you really only can have it if the privilege is set up right, right? I mean, this is, you know, if you're a victim of sort of institutional, whether it's sexism or racism or, you know, the poverty, like, there, I wonder if you thought about that as you're writing the book of, like, yeah, this makes a ton of sense, but for other people, if literally your life is in danger walking to school, you know, how do you claim agency?
Absolutely. No, we're all faced with our own unique challenges in terms of accessing and developing our level of agency. And poverty, and certainly living, you know, amidst violence, I mean, these are, in some respects, seemingly insurmountable tasks. How does someone survive that type of existence? And many people, in fact, do not. So, you know, what I have been thinking a lot about since writing the book, or while writing the book, is, you know, what role should local and federal government play in all this?
Yeah.
And part of it is, you know, focusing on helping people to develop agency. What are the things that help us to access our agency? And especially kids who grow up in, you know, really impoverished settings. Those kids have a much, much harder time.
Yep.
And, you know, it's not that they need a handout, but they need certain things to help them build agency for themselves. And we as a nation will benefit clearly from that. And like you said, just it's as simple as having a winter coat and gloves. And, you know, those little things make a huge difference.
So one of the problems, right, though, and you talk about this because you say in the book, quote, rigid adherence to an ideological framework reduces agency if it limits the scope of inquiry. And this is the problem with our political conversation in the country right now. We're not talking about the real things. We're not willing to engage in building models together. We're sort of standing with our team number, which is not relatable to truth.
No, great point. I'm so glad you brought that up because, you know, we are living in times, highly polarized times, as everyone knows, and it helps to kind of unpack that and understand what is that and why is it occurring, and what does it have to do with agency? Well, you know, I'll answer the last part of that first, which is, you know, we're stalled out. We're stuck, right? So agency is being thwarted on a national level. You know, good actions are not being taken on any number of fronts because we're stalled out, and polarization is largely at the root of it. And what polarization really is, it presents an opportunity for us to learn more, to understand more deeply where other people are coming from, right? To understand someone else's reality. And instead, you know, we point fingers at each other and we, you know, say, well, you know, you say that, but you, that's because you're conservative. Mm-hmm. Or you say that, but it's because you're a liberal. So we stay stuck in these boxes, these ideological sort of corners that really stall out exploration and prevent, you know, creativity and, most importantly, collaboration to solve a lot of the issues. So, you know, it's refreshing to see some new voices emerging, and we need to put aside all these, you know, old, I think, to make progress and access our agency as a nation. You know, put aside some of this, the old labels, the old ideologies, and you know, kind of explore new stuff and get some new things on the table. So that's my take.
Yeah, I think this is a classic. Both things can be true. You can be looking, you can have a problem with overall paradigms, and you can still engage individuals to play around with ideas. And this is the whole spirit behind Yes And, which is like you get nowhere just saying no, you know. But you and Yes And is all about the beginning of a conversation. It's not about an excuse to allow terrible behavior or unfair structures or any of that stuff. Let that off the hook. It's really about at a baseline no. Knowing that we are creatures who are going to live in no or no but, and we don't go. There's no new scripts that get written when we live in that world.
No, that's exactly right. There's, you know, I think that ties in so beautifully to improvisation because, in point of fact, you know, we're making it up as we go along.
Yeah.
That is the human condition, right? And you know, we've been making many changes to how we live, many of those things driven by technology. And, you know, we now face big problems that we don't have all the answers to. And that's where improvisation comes into play. We need to come together and think these things through and put some of our belief systems aside and just get focused on what are we dealing with and how do we collaborate to solve some of these issues. And that's hard, right?
Yeah, it is
that's
hard.
Very hard for human beings.
Yeah, totally. All right, I'm going to ask you shortly for each of you for a yes and story, which is always how we end the podcast. But I had a couple other. The way I organize my notes when I read a book is I always have a section that's other because it doesn't fit into a larger framework. But I have two items from the book that I really wanted to sort of get your feedback on. One is, quote, many people don't realize that they increase their level of influence by strategically ceding power at times. Tell us how that works.
I can jump in on that. I do it every day, particularly with kids and young adults. You know, parents come in and they have a laundry list of complaints or problems or issues, or the teachers have said this or the coaches have said that. And can we, you know, put a label on it and fix it and then, you know, get the door closed one to one? I've got to say to that kid, look, I don't know what it's like to be in fourth grade. You know, it's been a long time. Mm-hmm. What are other kids doing? And sometimes I even put the height of my chair down a little
right.
bit. I also don't make a ton of eye contact in the beginning. I get kids up and moving, maybe throw a ball around. Like what I do is you just find every way to bring sort of like your physical authority down, and you just become a good listener. And you ask them more general questions, and you get them sort of warmed up that way.
Yeah.
Yeah. The power of asking a good question is so important. And I was listening to your interview with Amy Edmondson mm-hmm. recently, Kelly, and yeah, she talks about that. And you know, we have an entire chapter in the book devoted to the principle of positioning yourself as a learner, and that in many to adequately do that, you really have to kind of cede some of your power. Well, it feels like you may be ceding your power because you're asking questions and exploring. And, you know, that's best done when you're partnering with another person, you know, as an equal, not as, you know, as somebody, you know, who's lording your power over another human being. So anyway, that is how it works, is asking these questions, being, you know, open-minded, and, you know, sometimes people feel like that's ceding their power, you know, their power to direct, their power to tell, that is in some ways holding that in abeyance.
Yeah, there's a classic comedic trope with this, which is in comedy duos, you always have traditionally a high status and a low status person. And the joke comes always when the low status person gets it right over the high status person, right? Yeah. Laurel and Hardy, you know, like, and that and it's a court jester idea, right? It's the way that one can speak truth to power and get to truth is often when you're in the lower status. One more. Why do we need to guard against magical thinking?
So, because it's great when you're, you know, 7, 8, or 9 years old. a little of it works great, in fact. But it's you end up with a sense that the world is a place that I don't have to change or change myself to move myself forward and grow as a person. Like, in a lot of ways, it's this what we call external locus of control of the world. It'll just all work out, where the world is all set up, so that when bad things happen, I just say, well, that's the way it is. And you're just really ceding a lot of your personal power if you continue with that. So I mean, that's my take from it.
Yeah, I mean, my take on that is how we show up in the world is really important. And, you know, as we all know, you know, we do have real problems to address, both in our lives as you know, individually and as a culture. And, you know, in some ways, if we just magically assume things will take care of themselves or somebody else will fix it, you know, that's probably making, I mean, that is making an inappropriate assumption. So, you know, showing up and being willing to partner with other people to explore things and figure things out and to improvise, you know, back to, you know, some of the core principles you work on is, you know, that's much better than magically thinking everything is going to work out.
Yeah, I mean, that's why we're having the conversation. I distinctly remember I was at Kim Scott's house and I had used the term agency like 25 times. And she's like, hey, do you know about this book? And indeed, she sent me the link to your work. And I'm like, ah, okay. And what I love about that is we're all working in these very different fields. But when you realize at the core, we're all dealing with matters of the human condition and how they express themselves across a variety of platforms. But the basic stuff is not different. The basic stuff is all the things we wrestle with. And I think we've done ourselves a disservice in this life, especially the work-life balance, in thinking that somehow they're different when I enter into a building with a tie, and they're different when I enter into a home engaging with my child. And that's really what this book is about. It's about all of this stuff.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. It's we try to distill down in this book the core sort of principles for humans that bolster and build a greater sense of agency. And, you know, agency is, as you said, Kelly, it's fundamental. It really is the bedrock of, you know, all the conversations we've been having about, you know, how to better adapt in this environment versus that environment. You know, they all come back to agency, and that has to do with how we feel about ourselves. It has to do with how we are, you know, kind of developing, you know, ourselves and growing. So it truly is fundamental. And, you know, I think that what we found in writing the book is that a lot of people are feeling, you know, disempowered. You know, they're not feeling they have access to their full agency. And, you know, so we wanted to explore that and understand what's going on there. Why are people reporting to us, you know, in our respective, you know, walks of life, you know, Tony's in mind, hey, you know, why are they feeling that? And what are the ramifications of that? And so anyway, it gets right to the heart of things. And Kim Scott has done an amazing job in her book. She's wonderful. The whole idea of being candid, I mean, showing up, having empathy, you know, trying to get into somebody else's shoes for a moment, see the world through their eyes, and developing a candid conversation.
Also not easy. That's the...
Not easy. No, it sounds easy, right? It conceptually, it sounds simple, but it actually isn't simple. And, you know, and that is a parallel to agency, because agency sounds simple too. It's, you know, how do you access your power?
Right.
Well, you know, you ask people that question and they struggle. They scratch their heads. They think, well, boy, you know, not really 100% sure. So we wanted to try to unpack this. And it is, as you said, Kelly, it is the fundamental question. It's always been the fundamental question, but you know, today it's even more critical that we grasp this. And you know, I want to say one other thing about movies, because we talk, you know, Tony and I have talked a lot about, you know, why do people watch movies? And fundamentally, you know, we are drawn a lot of times to movies where agency is being explored and expressed. Mm-hmm. So you think about, you know, for example, Julia Roberts and Erin Brockovich, you know, she's a single person, an individual who takes on something much larger than herself and succeeds at this really improbable task. And fundamentally, we're always looking for messages as humans on that. It inspires us, and it inspires us to be at our best. And we need more and more of that today, because there's so much negativity, and I think people feel so bogged down by it. So it's, you know, again, these are really, really central, fundamental concerns.
Yeah, I think that's one of the reasons Michael Lewis's books do so well, and many of them get turned into films, is because they both have that idea of these central figures, and they're also dealing with sort of cutting-edge thinking in the variety of fields. Okay, we could talk all day about this. Tony, do you have a yes-and story for us?
Yes, I do. It's a little unusual, but here we go. I'm going to give you a little quick history. When I was six, I nearly drowned, and it was, you know, just large city pool, outdoors, no lifeguards, just... you know, crowded, noisy, and I got separated somehow and just went from the small end, literally dropped into the deeper end. And I just, you know, it was a terrifying experience, obviously, and by the time I was rescued out of that, I had written off most swimming or boating or fishing or sailing for most of my life. I would do it once in a while, but I just, for years and years and years, just, you know, didn't want to learn how to swim. And many people had approached me and said, look, you know, I can teach you how to do it. And I always said no, until a colleague, he's actually sitting next to me right now, who's a great swimmer. And he said, you know, I'm working at a counseling center right now, one of the colleges around here in Boston. You know, the pool's pretty much empty early evening. I'll take you in. I'll give you some lessons. And I said, yes. And, you know, you know, any chance I get, I jump in and I try to swim somewhere, and I get myself on water. And what I realized was I was feeling a little bit of a fraud with a lot of the kids I was working with, because they're coming in with a lot of fears and anxieties, and I've got my little bag of tricks to help them,
yeah,
you know, desensitize and be less anxious and move on. And but you know, facing that fear was incredibly important. Whenever I'm facing something big, it is a little bit like being the kid in the pool again, and I've got to sort of always slay that dragon.
That's great. Paul, do you have one?
Yeah, I got a brief one to share. It's more immediate because it's about this book, which is, you know, this book originally started out, the project started out as Anthony's project. He was working on it. He was consulting with me, and getting some advice. And finally, at a certain point, he said, you know what, we should be writing this book together, because, you know, you see things I don't see and vice versa. And, you know, you bring in a different skill set than I have. So I immediately jumped to, no, I don't have time. Right. You know, this is your project. You know, I just didn't see myself, you know, as pursuing a writing career, either. And so, but I decided to give further thought to it. So the yes and moment was, you know, putting a shoe in the door and saying, well, all right, let me think about it. And as I reflected on it, I thought, you know, I actually do have a lot to say on this topic. I'm very interested in it. I want to learn more myself. And so I came around and said yes. And, you know, it's been a life-changing decision, actually, because, you know, committing to writing a book takes years of work and lots of research. And I've learned a tremendous amount along the way. It's been incredibly fun and enriching. Now I'm very glad I made the decision.
That's great. The book is called The Power of Agency. Paul Napper and Anthony Rao, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks so much for having us.
It's great.